I'm Matt Josoff from Fix Income Research, and you're listening to At Any Rate, our global research podcast where we take a look at the story behind some of the biggest trends, themes, and industries in markets today. I'm joined by Josh Younger and Munir Salem to talk about convexity hedging in this extraordinary market that we see right now. To put things in perspective, we just saw the 10-year note approach 1% this morning, which is a historical low. And I think there have been a number of factors that have been driving this. But one of the things I think that our team has been really focused on is convexity hedging. We know that investors had been offsides over a year ago when it's clear that people expected the Fed to be hiking rates, and instead what they got delivered were multiple cuts in rates. So I wanted to ask Josh a little bit about kind of who are the big convexity hedgers out there today, and how does that affect the markets?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess fundamentally the question we want to answer is, who's buying the 10-year note at 1%? Right? Is this an investment decision, or is it a risk management decision? And I think in a lot of cases, or at least among a big component of the market, it's really a risk management decision. So what do I mean by that? There is a whole population of negative convexity investors, and their assets tend to shorten when rates rally. And mortgages are the prime example of that, where they're more likely to be prepaid, so they behave like shorter duration assets. And so when rates rally like this, that whole population gets very short the market. So you're getting short the market into a rally, which is precisely the opposite of what you want to do. Banks are hit two different ways in this sense. The first is they have mortgages. So the same way that mortgages shorten in general, bank mortgage holdings shorten. That's on the asset side. On the liability side, their deposits are extending because deposits tend to get sticky when rates are low. So when your liabilities are getting longer and your assets are getting shorter, as rates are rallying, that's a pretty punitive setup for an investor. And banks in particular are both short convexity these two ways and very large. The banking sector is just enormous relative to others. So in the past, we used to focus on, say, REITs and servicers and the GSEs. Banks are, you know, $16 trillion balance sheet. And so as their deposits have been lengthening and their assets have been shortening, they've been forced to chase the market. And again, this is a risk management exercise. This is to make sure that they don't keep getting shorter as rates keep going down. So it's less about the yield on offer, and it's more about that sort of Greek management.
Well, it seems like they're still leaning on the short side. In other words, they haven't covered this. If you look at their NII, it's still very sensitive to rates based on their own company disclosures. If you look at their AFS portfolios, you can see that their assets have been shortening based on the numbers that they disclose. So what do you think banks' position is right now?
I think they're quite short just because they had so much ground to make up. The banking system in general, large commercial banks, we had an estimate of around $1.25 trillion in 10-year equivalent net short position. Now, that's more than the Treasury net issues in a big year. Like this year, they're going to do less than that. So to get back to flat relative to last March, they'd have to buy more Treasury supply than actually gets created in a given year, which is clearly not an easy exercise to engage in. And the other part of this is that banks not being mark-to-market investors, they're held-to-maturity investors, right? They're not sensitive to these small fluctuation in the value of their assets and liabilities. But at some point, you just have a sufficiently large exposure that you have to think about managing that down. And so you'll see interest rate sensitivities pick up just because the banks are not going to hedge every 5 basis point move in interest rates. But when you move 100 basis points, it starts to matter quite a bit because their forward earnings stream becomes very sensitive to future moves in interest rates. And that's not a great proposition from a shareholder value perspective.
So when you look at the options for banks, the big sectors within fixed income are mortgages, corporates, and treasuries. They don't typically like to buy corporates because of the high capital requirements. Treasuries have no spread by definition. So you're left with mortgages, which used to make up over 40% of the dollar duration of the fixed income market and are now way less than 10%. So there's really not a lot of duration out there. What do you think banks are going to buy? What are they going to do?
So they want to do two things. One is they want to add duration, and the other is they want to do it in a accounting and regulatory friendly way. So from an accounting perspective, you want hedge accounting or held to maturity. So that means either I'm receiving in swap against floating rate assets. I could be tearing up issuance hedges. So I have issuance hedges that are long-dated liabilities swapped to float, synthetically creating short-dated liabilities. Well, maybe I want to extend those out. The other version of this is to just buy bonds in a held-to-maturity portfolio. Right? And the problem with that is balance sheet costs money these days. Regulations make it harder to simply grow. And so adding bonds is not necessarily an option, either on the corporate side for a bunch of reasons or even on the treasury side, simply for that GSIB and other balance sheet cost reasons. So best way to do this is to receive fixed in swaps against your loan book, which means you should see it in the way that swap spreads trade relative to moves in interest rates. Now, we haven't seen that yet, I think in part because of the speed with which we've moved lower in rate. We haven't necessarily seen this activity pick up, but you definitely saw it last August. So you've seen this case study evolve in real time last summer, and there's no reason, we think, to expect it to be dissimilar this time around.
And then briefly, let's move on and talk a little bit about the other investors out there, servicers and REITs. How are they positioned and how important are they?
Yeah, so the servicers, so typically we break this into the banks are big and slow moving. The REITs, the GSEs, Fannie and Freddie, and the servicers are fast moving but smaller. So they have a different impact. On the fast moving side, the servicers are in a fairly unique position because we've rallied so hard so fast that they're actually positively convex, which means they have the opposite need. They actually get delivered long the market as rates rally. So that's a relatively stable setup, especially given the outlook. Now, REITs have a problem, which is they came into the fourth quarter with a negative duration gap. Now, what does a negative duration gap mean? It means you're basically paying to run your business. Like a REIT business model is to run a duration gap, apply leverage, and pay out that difference between long-term rates and short-term funding to your shareholders. Now, if you have a negative duration gap, that's not a good setup for that business model. And we think they came into the fourth quarter with a negative gap again, and that means that we've rallied since. So they're in a very precarious situation in a lot of ways. They're simply not as big as the banks, but they have the same problem in a sense.
So moving on to the market structure, Munir, you've talked about the liquidity and how that might have exacerbated this rally that we've seen. Tell me a little bit about that in general. How does that work?
Yeah, sure. So, the various players you can kind of blame for this move being arguably outsized, if you view it that way. Josh mentioned that these sort of liability hedging folks are kind of enforcing current levels. Another question, though, is how do we get such a large move to begin with? Like, why were the moves looking so magnified? Why is volatility in the elevated position it's in today? To sort of answer that question, we look at a few different metrics, primarily in the U.S. Treasury market. That's where we kind of have the best data. But, we're kind of looking at, first and foremost, who's providing liquidity? How much liquidity is being provided and who's doing it? To look at that, we kind of look at this metric called market depth, which is, how many bonds are on offer in the book? If I want to buy or sell in large size, how many orders can I work through before I begin to really move the price around? And that kind of amplifies vol. When times are good, it's very deep, very liquid. When times are bad, it kind of becomes a much thinner book. And unsurprisingly, last week we saw kind of a deterioration in this liquidity metric. It kind of started a little later in the week, which was kind of interesting. If you look back in August, we mentioned August is another big shock event to the market. Liquidity kind of vanished pretty rapidly. It was surprisingly resilient until maybe Thursday, Friday of last week. It really started to deteriorate. So that was something interesting that we've been paying close attention to.
Okay. And can you tell us a little bit about specifically how that works and how liquidity actually impacts this rally then?
Yeah, sure. So the idea is, you have folks who are coming in and they're kind of asked to buy or sell. When the book is nice and deep, they move the price around in subtle ways. When it becomes thin, as we see right now, you see metrics like price impact rise. So, for $100 million of flow, the average move in the price is now higher than it was, say, like a week ago. And if we look at that metric, we call that price impact. It's kind of spiked to a level that we, again, last saw over the summer. That kind of amplifies volatility, leads to sort of larger price moves.
Okay. So, kind of bringing it together, we're seeing a fundamental situation where we have investors, especially banks, who are short duration and pretty large size, and we have that compounded by the lack of liquidity in the market overall. So given where we are in the market, what do you think, Josh, in terms of where rates are biased from here? are we at the end of this, or do we still have more of a rally to come?
Yeah, well, I'm not going to get too prognosticating on the timing of things. I think the key is the bias in the setup, like you mentioned. So the convexity demand that we're referring to from banks especially, but also from REITs, is really two things. It's an accelerant, which is important and likely had something to do, although certainly not entirely, with the ferocity of the rally that we've seen. The second is it's a backstop. So when rates rise, if you're net short and you can get a slightly better yield tomorrow than today, well, then I'll probably buy the market there. So what it means is there's a pent-up demand for duration, which we alluded to in the beginning, which is exceedingly large. $1 trillion is a lot of money. And likely to get covered over time. And so we've seen some of that. Like since last summer, we've seen some covering. We just think it's unlikely it's been totally covered. So as rates rise from here, there's going to be a backbid essentially from the banking community, from the insurance community, from the REIT community, from this whole population of quote-unquote negative convexity investors, but especially the banks are the ones we're watching just due to the size of their exposure.
Right. Okay. Well, with that, I'd like to thank you for joining us, Josh and Munir. And for our investors out there, you can find a lot more information on this in our most recent Fixed Income Weekly, which is available by email or on our JP Morgan website. Thanks very much. Thanks for joining us. Stay tuned for more episodes of At Any Rate, JP Morgan's Global Research Podcast Series. This communication is provided for information purposes only. Please read JP Morgan Research reports related to its contents for more information, including important disclosures. Copyright 2020 JP Morgan Chase & Co. All rights reserved. This episode was recorded on March 2, 2020.